IMRO's 2023 Best Local or Regional News Programme. The Voice of the Northwest, the 9 till noon show with Greg Hughes.
And you're very welcome back to the programme at 8 minutes past 10. Thanks again to John, Kathy and Mary for their contribution over the last hour, and to all of you too, listening to us and texting in. The truth is the truth, says this listener. Whether it's subject to libel or not, the real problem is that the mainstream media don't want to hear the truth anymore. Well, you see, it's not really... I mean, obviously, the truth is the truth. But say, for instance, there's certain things that we can't talk about. Let's say, for instance, it's careful to give examples without getting there. But let's just say there was a particular crime, and the perpetrator of that crime was named broadly on social media, or the suspected perpetrator of that crime. We could not say that information. There'd be quite serious consequences for doing so until such time as that person was actually charged. Another caller says there is a genuine fear in rural communities about large numbers of strangers moving into an area. It doesn't matter where they are from. They could be 100 Dubliners and the fear would still be there. Calling people far right is nonsense, and the public know this. Name calling is the government's excuse for not engaging with communities where DP and refugee centres are. I think many people might agree with that comment. Mary, showing a side of Ireland that I believe are few in number. When you start using historical facts of Irish moving abroad to support your argument for open borders, you've lost. Let's put an end to this discussion for once and for all. I'm pretty to the people of Ireland. Put it to the people of Ireland in a referendum, and people like Mary will discover, I believe, a huge silent majority there are against immigration at the present level. Important thing to realise is that this very discussion is being held in houses all over Europe. But how, well, the EU has in itself introduced new rules and regulations in this regard. But how would you word that referendum? What question would you put to the people? What about the bad men in the Israeli and American gangs butchering, killing and slaughtering innocent men, women and children in Gaza? Why isn't Mary crying out about that on the airwaves? Well, I didn't ask her about that. I take your point. But her not talking about it doesn't mean she doesn't care about it. I really can't believe I heard this lady say that they're trying to block all freedom of speech or even this introduction of hate speech. Why are they so afraid of people communicating with each other? Just because they don't like what people are saying does not give them the right to stop it. I personally believe that the government's fault at this stage. You can't blame people wanting to better their lives, but when there is no homes, jobs, etc., who's really helping who here? Yeah, and my wish was, I don't think people should be censored for I think people should be able to speak freely. I don't think freedom of speech should extend to the freedom to, you know, racially abuse someone or abuse someone based on their gender or what have you. I mean, if how they look, someone calls me a baldy git or this, that and the other. I mean, people should be able to say that, and people will always be able to say that. But I think sort of like targeted harassment, I think there is a space whereby we could limit that. I just wish, as I say, that everyone right across the political spectrum or of all points of views challenged things and said, could that be true, or does that make me feel more comfortable in my point of view? And that's whether you would be left, right, middle, wherever you are. A caller says the Dublin gangs are very evil people, but at least they are by and large slaughtering their own, which is a remarkable thing to come out with. How many Irish people are guilty of stabbing children coming out of a school? I think if you go into a restaurant and you open fire with an automatic weapon, a machine gun, in a busy restaurant on New Year's Eve, I don't think really that... That could have been anyone or any of our children. A caller says, we do not have busloads of Irish men put in accommodation beside schools. Busloads of men is the point, Mary, says another. Ask the bin men. They will tell you about food waste. Another, hi, Greg. Pity Charlie McConnell. Well, I'm not going to read that one. I'll get myself into trouble. But noted. Golf Gates mentioned there. I wonder, is Minister McConnell going to ask the restaurants to lower their prices with less on the plate? Good old Charlie McConnell looking to starve the Irish people now. Hi, Greg. Things are just got far too expensive in Ireland. You go now for a night away, two people and a bite to eat and a few drinks, it'll cost you a week's wages. Yeah. Another, it's the deputies of this county that are responsible for a lot of what is happening to the people of Donegal. Just shows how out of touch they are. There are a minority of bad females from other countries and from Ireland too, says a listener. People are not against families or even individuals moving here. In fact, we have been very welcoming. Seems to me it's now It's the secrecy and the large numbers in rural areas with nothing to do. Seriously, just because we have bad men here doesn't mean that we should be open to receiving more from a completely different cultural and country. We now have to have a guard check to travel anywhere now. And I, as I said, I articulated that point to Mary during that conversation. What seems to be when I'm out and about and when I'm sitting in this chair, what people are most concerned about. Of course, as I accept climate change is impacting our world, but the reason for a lot of flooding is many of these buildings are on floodplains, definitely. And listen, you take a hilly area like Letterkenny, for an example, and you tarmac and concrete over where the water would normally have flown, and you don't put in adequate drainage. I'm not saying that there isn't adequate draining, I'm just using it as an example. You're going to cause flooding in certain areas. The water has to go somewhere. So planning is key. And listen, a lot of the areas that do flood, the houses that do flood, were built on floodplains. Maybe establishments overserve portions to Charlie and co. because of who he is and his influence. It's possible, yeah. People take the food home that they bought. It's not that their so-called politician tells us, well, he's a politician, do we have our own minds? Greg, we were in a cafe yesterday and it was so cold, we just left. This is winter. The food was cold, was it? Or the premises was cold? A caller believes that maybe the big portions are in the subsidised bar and restaurant in Leinster House. Government, Gov claimed they give €450 energy to people, then take VAT off. It's actually given them just over €400. Restaurants overload plates. We pay crazy prices half fed. They don't believe plates are overflowing. If they supplied doggy bags to everybody in the restaurant would have no food waste. Okay, well, I mean, that's, you know, I very, very rarely leave much behind me. Okay, listen, let's take a break. Seamus Gunn's going to be joining us after these messages. And you are very welcome back to the programme. We are really different up here, you know, in this part of the world. And we get evidence of that all the time. I note there is an organisation called Digital Funnel. They sent through a press release and they analyse internet search data, you know, what people are searching for or what they're not searching for. And their latest release is as it relates to Ryan Tuberty last year. And it goes through all the different counties, the different towns who searched for the name Ryan Tuberty, because of course he was very prominent in the news. 34,000 monthly Google searches for Tuberty's name in 2023 in Ireland. But what town in all of Ireland would you say searched that name least? Here, Letterkenny. What county was least interested in that story in terms of searching his name? Donegal. So, as I say, it just goes to show we do tend to be somewhat different up here. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Co. joins us on the programme now. Happy New Year, Seamus. Great to have you back on the programme for 2024.
Thanks, Greg. Yeah, very happy New Year to yourself and all your listeners. Yeah. Everyone there at Highland, yeah. Hope it's a good one.
Hopefully so. Before we get to some questions, and we've been very busy on the phone lines, the lead story, which in and of itself is a story, I think, today in Ireland on the Nationals, was the fact that Oscar Pistorius has been freed on parole nearly 11 years after murdering his girlfriend in a case that made global headlines. The former Paralympic champion, once celebrated as the Blade Runner, was granted parole in November and today left a South African jail and is now at home, South Africa's Correctional Services Department said. Now, he does face some quite stringent sort of rules as part of that parole. Surprise, anything about that story jumps at you?
Well, there's probably a number. There's a number of things, and probably why it has attracted the attention it has on the global scale and even nationally. Now, it's really a Jekyll and Hyde type story. The background, the way in which he, as an individual himself, during his lifetime, faced down massive adversity. He challenged the system. He got amputated both legs when he was a child, and then became known as in the worldwide as the Blade Runner. And he championed the cause of the underdog, in particular those with disabilities. So I mean, and he's to be lauded and applauded for that. And then he even challenged then to get into the able-bodied Olympics because he was already qualifying in the Paralympics. Of which he was extremely successful. And people forget that he went to three of those and won something like six or seven medals. And they're all gold medals, by the way. So, and then he challenged the system to actually get into the Olympics proper. And he was turned down by the Olympic Federation at that point. And he challenged that. And then he won that appeal, and he got into the Olympics then in London, and he got he advanced tonight to the semi-finals there. So the ascent, you know, the highlights that he got to and achieved were remarkable for somebody so disadvantaged starting out in life. And then the fall from grace, which was nearly immediately after London in 2013, when this incident occurred with his girlfriend, which is still kind of inexplicable in many ways, you know, the whole circumstances. And believe it or not, I remember us maybe talking about that at the time on this particular programme because of just the manner in which it was done, the shooting through the lavatory door, the number of shots and that. And that was actually, that was kernel to the manner in which the case then proceeded, because he was not initially convicted of murder. It was culpable homicide, and he got a very short sentence. This is overlooked, though, which this is very interesting. He was actually out of jail after 1 year from the first sentence, but for 5 years he got released after 1 year, and he was on parole. It was then, the appeal then came up in relation to that. And then they said, well, no, he should have been convicted of murder. And that was what was upheld. So after a number of months free, he was then taken back, and the sentence handed down was 6 years. What happened next? They increased that to 13 years. Well, so, you know, you have to, in some ways, when you look at it objectively, think, well, you know, now that he's been released after half a sentence, you think, well, he is certainly, I think he's paid... He paid a serious price, you know, his fall from grace. And under the system in South Africa, he's entitled to, after 50% of his time served, to be rehabilitated and to be allowed out on parole. So we have this, as I said, nearly a Jekyll and Hyde situation where this incident occurred, and there's no history of violence at all or anything like that. And he gave his explanation, saying he thought it was an intruder. This was what came out. Now, up to this day, I think Reeva Steenkamp's mum, June, does not believe that, and she has questioned marks about that. But she has been very magnanimous too, because she has said, well, in order for her to get on with her life and live, I have to park this now. And she's quite complimentary of the parole system over there. Now, he'll be on a heavy leash, though, Greg, for a number of years yet.
Yeah.
So even though he's out, he's still under sentence until... in the latter half of 2029, I think. So he'll be under certain conditions. He'll have to spend time at home. I think he's going to live with his uncle. And then he'll be closely observed and monitored. And whatever he does, I don't think he can partake in any media-type activity. So his life will be restricted, but it will be a whole lot better than being in the correction centre. There's no doubt about that. But... If you look at the system in South Africa, which I find is of interest, they put a lot of emphasis seemingly on the restorative justice aspect, because he met the deceased father in 22, and he obviously complied with everything that was required of him while he was detained. And when he did partake in that, he applied for his 50% remission, as it were. He's released now, and I think he has served his time. He will continue to do so. He won't be in the public domain until the latter part, 2000, maybe in 30, say, but he's only around 37 years of age. So I think there's going to be another chapter in Oscar Pistorius. And, you know, in time, I'm sure it you could be going to watch it in the cinema.
Oh, without a doubt, indeed, if there's not already some sort of a B film having been made of it. Yeah. And as you say, the family really gracious, I think. Well, gracious, is that the right word? Just very well, magnanimous, yeah, very well chosen words, recognising the fact that they are going to continue to serve this life term, but also welcoming, as you've quite rightly pointed out, the restrictions placed on him. I just wonder sometimes if a story like that would dominate the headlines in this day and age like it did 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, I was slightly surprised, Greg. I had just spotted it during the week that it was due, but it was well down the pecking order. And I didn't realise that this morning it was going to come with the same prominence. And I think that is because of the impact the individual had globally, and in particular during his sports days, because Like he's definitely one of the greatest sports people of all time because of his achievements and how he actually was able to participate with the amputations in the Olympics in London and got to the semi-final of the 400 metres with able-bodied persons. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement in itself. So I suppose that really does, deserve comment, and that's why it's been highlighted today, right across the world. But there'll be a lot more to come, and I think there'll be a lot more heard of Oscar Pistorius, whatever challenges he goes for next.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Seamus, stay with us if you don't mind. I'm going to take a quick break, and that clears the decks then for us to get to callers, listeners' questions. Stay with us, back in less than two. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Co. Remelton the Letterkenny is with us now. Is still with us now, should I say. I lent a person money on a gentleman's agreement and have text messages to back this up, Seamus. Promises to repay the $10,000 have been unsuccessful. He simply is saying I don't have it, as plans for its use didn't work out. Yeah. Can I do anything about this, Seamus?
Well, yes, he certainly can do something about it, but there's a certain background that we probably would require to know before he would be encouraged to pursue it at all. It's nearly at this stage, I'm saying to you, as a case, it would have reservations. He hasn't given a time scale, but from the very outset, if it's over 6 years since this was done, since this loan was made, and it hasn't been pursued in the meantime, he could be met with a defence that the matter is statute barred. Now, if there's an acknowledgement during that period, and this is quite important, that if there is an acknowledgement or a payment of some sort during that period, that'll keep it alive and keep the statute alive. So we'd flag that up as being, that's a problem. But let's say that he can establish that it's in recent times and there's text messages there to indicate that there was a loan, it was acknowledged, and it was to be repaid, and he has all them ducks in a row, which is a start, and he wants to pursue it. So then he has to issue debt collection proceedings and follow up with the individual. Now, it's already sort of been flagged up that the individual has in some difficulties with making the repayment. So even if he gets a judgment from a court and pays the money to do so, which he will have to do, by the way, and pay that money up front to a lawyer to pursue the matter, and succeeds, if the individual doesn't have an asset that he can attach it to, or even try to attach it to earnings or whatever, then he could be in the very frustrating situation where, as I've sometimes said, it could be good money after bad. Mm. I'm not saying it is, but he'd want to know the background of the individual he's following, want to know what assets are there. Now, if the individual had assets and there's big mortgages on them, he could secure a judgment, but it would come in after those mortgages. So, and he could register that and then seek to sell property and then seek for payment. So at least there would be some, as it were, a target that he could go after as an asset. But once there's enough equity in it, that will pay him. So those are all aspects of it that would sort of cause me a good bit of concern before you even start. Mm. And the one thing is this, and remember this, it's going to cost money. He's $10,000 down. He has to weigh it up then. Is he going to get it back? If he gets a judgment, is there anything that he can get it off with the individual? Yeah. And if there isn't, just have to really reconsider the position. And so he'd be better off having a word with his lawyer about it and seeing can he make some headway. It's terribly frustrating. If it's acknowledged during the period, it might keep the case alive. He has to decide then if the individual is a mark for being able to actually extricate the money whenever he finishes this course. And that, as I say, can be expensive.
Yeah, he talked about it being a gentleman's agreement. Is that very relevant? In other words, say, for instance, they both sat down and drew up an A4 paper and both signed it and had a witness signed it. It wouldn't really, we thought, for all the reason you've outlined there, it doesn't sound like it might give him any further...
Well, it might. It helps them to get over maybe the first point we made, provided in the last 6 years. Mm. It is proof that we had, right, and call it a gentleman's agreement. Gentleman's agreement can be quite okay and enforceable. I would suggest there that if you wanted to do something simple in that, that he should have got maybe what's called a promissory note, a bit old-fashioned, but a promissory note where it'd say, I acknowledge that you've given me $10,000 and I agree to repay it, you know, over whatever years, or, and just as simple as that, and that's an acknowledgement signed and dated, et cetera, and maybe witnessed. So, but or if they had a, of course, like if you want to approach this, you know, professionally, they would go and draw up an agreement and sign it. Mm. But what comfort does that give him whenever you get to stage two, as I've described to you? Whenever there you are in court, you get his judgment because he has his agreement and he's entitled to get that. So he'll definitely get his judgment. It's then to enforce that judgment. That's the second stage of it. And once there's a, if there's a property there or whatever that it can be mortgaged and that can be put against, that then he definitely has an out, because he can then what's called well charge the debt against it. Not being too technical, but and then get an order for sale of that and then move on from there. Right. So there could be a relief, but if there's no assets, there may not be.
All right. My son's going into family court for complete custody of his children. Can I, as a grandfather, go into court with him as a support person?
Well, it could be possible, Greg. First of all, the family law division, for obvious reasons, is not open to the public. Now, there are certain situations where some press can be admitted in to report without, but certainly without referencing names or identifying people. He has not indicated whether he has a solicitor or a barrister representing him. If he does have, it will not. It's very unlikely that his father will be allowed in then as moral support. But let's say, if he's dealing with the matter himself, the custody application himself, and he has nobody as by way of moral support, the court in that situation has a discretion and could allow a friend or the parent or whatever in to just not to represent him, but to assist him and to support him. And that was called way back, that came in from England, called a Mackenzie friend. And the judge has that jurisdiction to allow somebody to come in and just give the individual. But if they are represented, remember, there should be no necessity for that whatsoever. And I would think it highly unlikely that they would be admitted in that situation. Because you have to think about the other party, how that would influence them, the respondent in the case, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, it is a family situation. And so you don't want to disadvantage them in any way. Mm-hmm. And that's the purpose of the legal representation, that they would be, whoever that might be, would be representing them to put forward their arguments. But in the situation where the individual has nobody and wants somebody in to give them support within the proceedings, he could ask the judge, and there would be a discretion there, and that's what's called a Mackenzie friend.
Okay. Can I ask Mr. Gunn, if I want a divorce but I can't afford to move out of the family home, is it possible to get a divorce if both parties are still living in the same house? Now, obviously, no. there are issues living in the same house with someone you're divorcing and all that, but be that as it may, the situation is such, there's nothing, I presume, to prohibit you getting a divorce and living in the same house as the person you're divorcing, is there? Caught by law?
By law, since 2019, the requirement for a divorce is that you live separately in independent lives.
Okay.
And have been separated for a period of 2 years out of the last three. Before 2019, it was four out of the last five. So in the current year, it's 2 years separation. Now, how are you separated? You're absolutely correct in that you can be still under the same roof. Like, that's in modern living, and with, you know, the housing issues that are out there at the moment, and a house could be adopted to perhaps, you know, accommodate two individuals, maybe even two families. So there, that is not an actual prohibition, but let's face it, in practical terms, it might be going forward. You know, as life moves on and people move on, relationships move on, you know, it could become more difficult. But that would be for trashing out, as it were, at the time of the application to the court for the order for divorce, to see, well, you know, what rules are going to apply here afterwards. You know, up to now they're under the same roof, but is one going to move out, or are the two going to stay? And if they are staying, well, then is it a communal kitchen, or is it, you know, have to start and carry out?
Would the judge delve into all of that, like to sort of ensure that there wasn't a ruse going on? Let's say, for instance, in terms of, you know, payments that might be received or whatever, would it be the judge's role to dig into that to ensure that everything is as it seems?
And not that everything is as it seems, because he's not an investigator, or she's okay. Not an investigator. So it would not be the role. It would be the role of the representatives in relation to the application before the court to trash out the nitty-gritty of the terms and conditions, which would then form part of the court order for the actual divorce itself. And if a party then is in default on that, well, there would be certain remedies to it. But technically speaking, to answer the caller's question, it is possible and it could be done. Is it practical?
Doesn't sound comfortable. Anyway, whatever about practical. Should the solicitor give me an estimate of charges when I want probate done? If yes, any reason not to be given that information?
It's up to the individual and their representation and their solicitors to trash all this out. In many ways, how long is a piece of string? Because at the outset, if you're looking for a quotation, you have to be able to give the person the ingredients. Say if you're building a house, they do out what's called a bill of quantities. And the individual is given a bill of quantities, for example, and the builder then costs it and tells you what it's going to cost. Every single item, nearly the amount of nails are counted, right? Now, in that situation. So if you're coming along to a solicitor and say you want to take out probate, just as simple as that, well, there's a number of things to be clarified. You know, you're going to have to know what's in this estate, what assets are in it. You know, where are the assets? What is the value of the assets? You know, is there going to be any difficulty gathering them in? Has everybody been provided for properly in the will? Is there any chance of litigation? Is the title in order? So there are a number of aspects of it. I agree that a quotation is necessary and helpful, but what I think is necessary, is required actually legally, is the parameters in which the charges will apply.
Can there be a little bit of frustration in law in that, you know, I don't know what the general population view of solicitors are or having to engage with them. So maybe you can give me an insight into that. Is there this sense that, look, at you know, you tell me it's this amount and it should be that and you're my solicitor and, you know, like, is there a bit of a public attitude sometimes towards solicitors and their role or the importance of their role or what their, their defined role in a situation actually is?
Well, I think it's a fair comment to make, and the legal profession is very, very heavily regulated, and there's an obligation that at the outset of a case that the charges that are going to be applied will be documented and outlined to the client, and as to how they will apply and how they will be calculated. But the point I'm making is this, that without all the ingredients...
You need to know all the work involved.
The parameters at which we're going to work, mm-hmm. and they're the level of the fees at which we're going to work. And then there can be complications, etc.
You can't go to a contractor and say, how much is it to build this house? Yeah. And then halfway through say, when are you going to start the garage? The garage wasn't costed into it, I presume.
That wasn't in there in the first place.
Okay, I get you. Okay.
But the method in which the charges apply and the rate of the charge and that are applicable, that should all be outlined and documented at the outset. But I think that if you apply the same principles to any walk of life, like let's go into the medical profession, for example. You know, if you're going to say to a consultant, what's X, is this, or what's that going to cost? You know, are you going to try to have a bit of negotiation on fees? I don't think so. But I think that if there's clarity from the start as to the manner in which the fees will apply, then there shouldn't be any issue.
All right. Hi, Greg. Could you please ask Seamus? My mother passed away and left no will. There was no will made, but there are four siblings. I know we all have an equal share. My question is it right for one sibling to approach a solicitor and start proceedings without informing the other three siblings? Now, since this has all started, none of the other three siblings have had any letters or notification from the fourth solicitor. I've in fact called the particular solicitors three times and asked for a callback so we could find out what's happening, and no return call was given. There is also a few things from my mother's house that were taken, rings belonging to our grandmother, etc. The house was gutted. No information or any say was given to the other three siblings. Can this happen? Now, this is complex, and I don't think it's terribly rare either, unfortunately. And this is why everyone, you really need to make a very, very clear will. But go ahead, Seamus.
I definitely accept we have put that forward for long enough. This is a situation where there isn't a will. And the first part of it is fairly clear. There's one of the siblings wants to administer the estate, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that at all, because you're going to need somebody to administer the estate. So I'm assuming when the lady passed away that she herself was a widow. So now who steps in? One of the family, one of the siblings, or two of them, or even all four could be appointed the legal personal representatives. But the duty is not one, is the legal personal rep. That's the duty to administer the estate in accordance with law, and that's the Succession Act, because it now kicks in because there's no will. The difficulty, as you sort of foresee, is the practicalities of this, of dealing with the nuts and bolts of the estate, the personal effects, you know, of the individual. Now this allegation about jewellery and that, you know, it's distasteful, but it also it lends itself to bad feeling going forward and can polarise families. And I've always advised, advocated against that if at all possible. The advantage of the will, very simply, is this, is that an executor has been appointed to take charge of this by the deceased. So it could be one of the family, but at least that's the person then who is in charge and has seen that that was the deceased's wish. So someone now, some sibling, has stepped up and said, well, that'll be the administrator. That's perfectly correct. But that administrator has a duty to the other three siblings in this case, including to themselves, to deal with the estate and to divide it up equally, including the jewellery, by the way, and everything else, and account for everything that's in the estate, and also to secure it in the meantime. And that's the legal position. They can then, if they're not happy with that, well, there's certain steps they can take in applying to probate court, etc., and even to go as far as to try to have them removed. But you're getting into really expensive type
the
litigation.
Four siblings, sister, is there an
obligation? I wouldn't be really jumping into quickly.
Yeah, is there an obligation on the fourth sibling solicitor to engage with the other three siblings?
Well, they would usually make sense that they would engage, that they would let them know what the situation is. In general terms, as to where it's at. Remember, the first step is similar. It is still a probate application in that they require letters of administration to deal with the estate. So that you have to prepare the statement of affairs. And whatever's in the estate, in the statement of affairs, after the payment of debts, that's what has to be distributed among, in this case, the four children, yeah, and distributed equally. Now, there could be arrangements made whereby there's a pro rata split, or maybe one wants to purchase the dwelling or whatever, or there was an asset there that some of them would like to own, and they account for it by putting the money into the estate so that the others aren't disadvantaged by them gaining something. And there's absolutely nothing untoward about that. But at the end of it, remember, this is a family, and the last thing you want, and I'm sure for any person out there, deceased person, the person that's making arrangements and has now passed, the last thing they would want, and I've heard, is for there to be aggro afterwards, mm-hmm, and to have difficulties afterwards. And I've seen hundreds of people over my lifetime, thousands maybe, who have come in, and they've actually often qualify what they want to do by whenever they're going to make arrangements, by saying, well, they don't want to leave a situation arising after the pass away. And that's, if people would bear that in mind, even when dealing with the estate where there's no will made, would the person who's gone, what would they like in this situation? Would they like to see disharmony? Would they like to see fallout? Would they like to see polarisation?
Of course, even with a will, Seamus, that is not necessarily, unless it's incredibly detailed, going to account for a sibling saying, well, she always wanted me to have those rings, or, you know, she told me many a time that dresser was mine. You know, unless you're getting down to the real nitty gritty of items, that's often thrown up. I think that's all, you know, even so, get really detailed with the will, with very specific high valued items, then maybe.
Yes, especially personal effects. If there's items of personal effects of personal value to the person making, to the individual making the arrangements, that should probably better be dealt with during their lifetime, so that the family know that Mary's to get the rings or whatever, and, you know, that Johnny'll get the sideboard. So at least that it's well documented in advance. And even if it's kept as a memorandum with the arrangement, that these are the arrangements for the personal effects, it would be extremely helpful.
All right, Seamus, you're always extremely helpful. We do appreciate it. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company, with locations in Remelton and Letterkenny. And fingers crossed, Seamus, and I'll say before you do, still online as well.
Well, into another year, Greg, isn't it terrific? 2023, donegalsinstitute.ie.
2024, Seamus, just in case you're filling any documents out later.
2024, yeah.
All right, listen.
Maybe, and hopefully 25.
Yeah, indeed. Fingers crossed for all of us.
Gunn.ie, keep it simple.
Gunn.ie. Thank you very much, Seamus. Take care of yourself. Seamus Gunn there. Now, coming up after 11 o'clock, we have Michael and Katie in studio with us. And stay tuned if you don't normally do so. We talk about things that we're watching on the telly, things in the cinema, music, podcasts, books, whatever it might be. And over the months, your input has increased and increased, and we really appreciate it. And you can talk about anything you want. And the idea of it is, after what can be a hard week, talking about some really serious issues and issues that divide us and what have you, is that we just ease our way into the weekend, just talking about stuff that often we find ourselves talking about over the kitchen table or in a pub or wherever you might be, at a restaurant. What are you watching? What should I watch? Any recommendations? So if you have any questions or comments, get involved in that hour, please. Now, to take us a little bit closer to it, let me catch up on some of your comments which have been coming in today. Kevin in Dunlow, he's in early today. Hi, Greg. Are certain traditions still carried out, he asks, as well as Nollag na Mban? It's also the day to take down the decorations. Is that today? Is it the 6th? Is it not the 6th? I don't know. When did you take them down? Very early. I'm not going to lie to you. They went up early. As Kevin notes, they do go up earlier. I know people that religiously, not literally, will not take the decorations down. I thought it was the 6th of January. I'm open to correction on that because they fear it to be bad luck. But a lot of those people may not put their decorations up until, you know, a week before Christmas or what have you. I wonder, are most trees down at this stage? I would say, are you still switching the lights on? If the tree's still up, are you still switching the lights on? That's the question. Or are you just looking, after coming home from work, of a bare tree in the corner with no lights on, and you just can't face shoving it back up into the attic? Well, let us know. 086 60 25,000. Kevin, you can't ask a question without answering it yourself. Is your tree up? Is it down? Is it in? Is it out? Hello, Greg. I know this is talked about on your show regularly. My GP sent me up yesterday to the ED for an x-ray. I got there at 10 past 5 in the evening. I got my x-ray at midnight, and I'm still sitting here waiting on results since around 8 this morning. New patients are coming in now. It's packed again, Greg. Can you work your magic? Unfortunately, I'm not sure I have magic, but it's an ongoing issue. I think you did well to get an x-ray at midnight, to be honest with you, because some services aren't always operational all of the time. I hope everything comes back clear in the x-ray, and I hope you're out soon. I really do. Hi, Greg. We were in a hotel on Monday last for carvery dinner. No starter or dessert. Two adults and two older children, 11 and 13. And there was so much food waste, especially with the veg and potatoes. I'm not sure who could finish these plates. Okay, but it's a carvery, right? So you could go, like I would say, if on a carvery, I'd say, can I have just a couple of spuds, or can I have just a little bit of carrots? Were you vocal enough at the carvery? I'm not blaming you, and it's a great point, by the way. Even if someone else is putting the food on your plate, you know, we could maybe say just a little bit less. I don't know. Hi, Greg. I honestly get enough to eat in restaurants. I always clean the plate. Chips portions cut every place. I never get enough. I know I like my grub, but just saying, indeed. And listen, if you note, and it's not an accident, your chips can come in little fryer baskets or little silver tins that they're sticking out the top, and then you tip them out, and there's less than 20 chips there. That can happen too, can't it? Always like listening to John McAteer. He's always on the ball, indeed, as all our guests were this morning. But I know John holds a particular place in a lot of people's hearts out there. The factor of the matter is, the large majority of these young men are travelling from non-democratic countries with different values that we hold in the west of Ireland. Is in the early stages in comparison to see France and the UK. And you just have to look at the racial discontent on the streets of these countries. There seems to be no effort on the part of anyone, anywhere in Western country governments to integrate people. Hence, we end up with separate ghettos, for one of a much better word, for want of, but I understand what you're saying. You mean people congregated in areas, in their own communities, so to speak. There are areas in the UK which are pretty much no-go areas for the police. The problem is, we have many different cultures bringing their problems to our country and continuing their differences and arguments. But listen, there's many places in England, and there's many places in Dublin and Northern Ireland that are no-go areas for the police or the Gardaí. And it's not foreigners as well. And I'm not contradicting you. I'm just saying we can't be blinkered either. But they go on to say, if people voiced our concerns, they're tagged as extremist on the right. As we are a democratic country, let's have that, the referendum, and move forward with the policy supported by the majority of people, whatever they may be. Listen, we're going to jump to the Europe's tune, I think. I know there is one or two countries that did hold a referendum. I don't think that's the way we do things here. But look, if you look at the way people can now express their views publicly, if you look at the language that the opposition are using, Sinn Féin in particular, they seem to have been changing their stance somewhat, they would argue not, but anyway. And the government themselves pointing certain things out. There, I think there is coming an alignment of views to some extent, but not as not going as far as some may want. Citizens of Ireland are concerned about some of the people coming in, as the government's immigration control is a joke and literally doesn't exist. So what happens when anyone that voices concern is seen as far right or racist? The Irish public have every right to ask questions because it is the state that pays for this try to get into Australia. It's interesting because they will say, well, look, no, everyone's fingerprinted as they come in. And those fingerprints are checked against a number of databases, primarily in Europe, to see if anything flags. But the one question a journalist hasn't asked, and I've heard this so many times, right? But I can't understand why no journalist has ever asked it. But I never had an opportunity to ask this question yet. If someone comes into this country, regardless of where they're from, and their fingerprints are taken, because that's the vetting, so to speak, and if those fingerprints are flagged as a problem in Germany or something, what happens? Is that person instantly deported? Are they put straight back in a plane, or do they join the group of people that are refused access or refused right to stay in this country, but are never deported? So if they are fingerprinted and checked, what happens then? No one's asked, are they instantly put back in a plane, or what happens? I would be really interested in an answer to that question, just to see how the system is working, because it's all right saying that people are checked, but what happens if something is flagged on that check? If they've shoplifted, do they still get into the country? If they've perpetrated a sex crime, do they still get into the country? You know, that information is not out there, and I think that'd be really interesting to find out.